You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Wendy Call. Wendy, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Well, it is really an honor to be here.
Wendy, you're working on a lot of things, I imagine, unfinished books or other things. What can you tell me all the things that you're involved in at the moment, from essays to books that you're working on?
Yes, I'm working on a few different projects. In terms of writing, I'm working on a collection of essays that I am sort of tentatively calling Grief Ephemeral, with the L of ephemeral in parentheses, so it's about grief ephemera and grief ephemeral. And so it will be a collection of probably a dozen essays. About half of them are finished and have been published individually, and now I'm finishing up the other half of them. And then I also have a couple of translation projects going on, which are translating poetry.
And so let's start off with talking about the essays, and I know you're going to read to us as well. Tell us a little bit about this series of essays. They're all based on experiences of grief or the topic of grief. How is that done? That seems like such a kind of heavy subject, really.
It is a heavy subject, which is part of why it has been in process for a very long time. The original inspiration for these essays was the experience of taking care of my mother when she was terminally ill with cancer, which is something that inspires a lot of writers and artists to, you know, write about and incorporate into their artistic practice. And that was all 11 years ago now in my life. So I actually started the essays immediately after my mother's death because I was so interested in how our society, meaning sort of contemporary middle class U.S. society, tries to pretend that death doesn't happen and ignore it until the last possible minute. And I have to say, I think that in the 11 years since my mother died, we've actually come quite a long way in talking openly about end of life and thinking about how do we keep people home when they are sick and not send them away for other people who don't know them to take care of them. And that was the original inspiration. I also, as part of my interest in this, I did a couple of artist residencies where I could talk to people who were thinking about death and read the work of people who had been thinking about death. And so those two residencies, one was spending 6 weeks at the public hospital in Seattle, which is called Harborview Medical Center, which is an amazing place. And I followed around palliative care physicians and nurses and chaplains, et cetera, and therapists. And then I talked to people who had been given terminal diagnoses about how they were feeling about that. And then the other residency I did, which I spent a month at a historical archive in Massachusetts, and it's a historical archive that specializes in ephemera published or produced in the United States before 1821. And I was looking at how it was that we thought about and recorded and dealt with death and with grief, you know, in the kind of early days of the U.S., you know, history.
Right, right. That's fascinating. Well, let's see. I'd like to hear some from your essay. I mean, I know that subject is close to me, too. I'm so sorry to hear about your mother. I know that happened to me several years ago. My mother was dying, and she was an educator, so we also talked quite a lot about death. And one of the things that I was amazed to find is I read somewhere that that everybody wants to die in the middle of the night or away from you, and if you make an agreement to be present for that, it can change. And in my case, it was kind of amazing. I said to my mother, "Listen, you know, I read that people tend to die at night, so people don't have to be around them when they're dying, and I'd like you to die in the middle of the day if you have that choice." And she said, "Okay," and that's exactly what happened. It was kind of amazing.
That is fascinating.
But it also spoke to how we would talk about her dreams and what was going on, but it was also spoke to how you know, we don't talk about that. We don't want to hear about that. The oncologist told me, you know, it's great that you're here. Usually when somebody's mother's dying, everybody leaves town. You know, it's just not typical for someone to hang around. And so that's kind of fascinating. And all the ephemera that you're looking at, you see the history, in a sense, of grief, right, of how we've been handling it?
The history of grief and also the history of how we have really pushed death out of our homes. And I think now we're starting to come full circle, and more people probably are dying at home in the U.S. now than were, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. But one of the things that I thought was so interesting was how integral it used to be in our lives. It used to be that when we built houses, there would be a little room sort of off of the living room that was the coffin room. And it was actually the space where you would lay out the bodies, because certainly, you know, the people lived in your house and people were going to die in your house. And I remember the first time I was in a house that had a coffin room, and the people who lived in the house knew what it was, and I had never heard of such a thing. You know, now we would never build something like that in a house. It wouldn't be part of the floor plan. And so I think that we're starting to realize that, as you experienced with your mother, we do – I remember the hospice workers telling my family when they were working with us during the last months of my mother's life, people die the way that they live. And so if somebody wants to die alone, they're going to make that happen. If somebody wants to be surrounded by their family, that is more likely to happen. In my mother's case, we were all there the last hours of her life. And honestly, it was one of the richest and most beautiful experiences of my life, which when sometimes when I say that out loud, people recoil because it's such a strange thing to say.
Yeah, well, of course, I get that. Yeah, it's a wonderful thing to be able to be there for. And I mean, of course, a horrible thing. It's so sad and endless, but a wonderful thing to be able to do. I mean, it seems also that when there were coffin rooms, as you're saying, which I'd never heard of, at that time, there was also so much death around. I was just reading a biography on Lincoln, and what was amazing is just all the death around everybody all the time. They talk about all these other politicians whose kids are dying, whose wife dies, or, you know, I mean, there was more death happening than it seemed, and it was no more upsetting than it is now. People seem to really be getting mocked by it then, and this is, I guess I'm talking like 1860s to 1890s, at least.
Yes, yes. Well, for most of us, you know, life expectancy has gone up. You know, certainly there are groups in the U.S. that I still think experience a lot more death than, you know, my family does, as, you know, a family of middle-class white folks who have health insurance, which puts us actually in a minority. But I do think, especially when you think about small children, one of the things that has changed so enormously since that time is infant survival rate. And I remember when I learned that, you know, about mourning art, as in mourning, that mourning art and mourning dress were a huge part of our artistic practice and of how we dress day to day, and that there was a time, you know, earlier than the 1860s, sort of pre-Civil War era in the United States, in which most women were in some stage of formal mourning for every year of their adult life because they were losing babies and small children and then their parents and then their spouse. And so much of the portraiture that we see of women wearing something black, that's because they were officially mourning, you know, an immediate family member that they had lost.
Amazing. And so tell us, you're going to read something from an essay first. Is that correct?
Yes, I think I'm going to read from the end of an essay because it sort of relates to what we're talking about here, which is actually being around people at the end of their lives and when they die. And this is an essay that is called Apothecarium, and it is an abecedarian, which means it's a 26-part essay with one part for each letter of the alphabet. And this essay was directly inspired by the work that I did in that historical archive in Massachusetts, which is called the American Antiquarian Society. And they have an artist-in-residence program for artists working in all media. It's quite fascinating, the people that they have come there and use material from the archives in their artwork in different ways or use it as inspiration. And so one of the things I found when I was in this archive was an apothecary's notebook that was from the first half of the 19th century. And we couldn't find any information about this notebook in terms of whether it had been transcribed before, whether scholars had ever studied it. Nobody had actually looked at it in the archive for quite a number of years when I came upon it. And I spent a lot of my month there attempting to transcribe this apothecary's notebook because I found it so fascinating. And also, I was interested
It was a handwritten notebook?
It was literally a handwritten recipe book of a couple of different apothecaries. And so there were recipes in there that are medicinal treatments we still use today, and there were recipes in there that are highly toxic and would, you know, kill you if you made them. So I created this essay that is sort of bringing together excerpts from the apothecary's notebook with moments in my experience of being with my mother at the end of her life. And one of the things I found interesting was that when you really look at some of our current chemotherapy treatments, they're quite toxic in a way that 150 years ago, 180 years ago, we were giving people quote-unquote medicine that was highly toxic. So I can read a little bit from that essay. I'm actually going to read a couple of bits from the end. So this will be
okay.
W and Y and Z of this Abecedarian essay. And so the first section that I'm reading, and you'll know by the language, is a direct quote from the apothecary's notebook, and then there's my little response to what was in the apothecary's notebook.
Okay, so. Let me just ask you before you read. You said it was Abecedarian, I believe, right? That means there's the lines don't necessarily start with a letter, but they don't start with that
right.
letter in the alphabet. Or, right.
So this is an Abecedarian essay, not an Abecedarian poem. So it's an essay with 26 parts, and then each part has a title, which is you know, the letter of the alphabet, or, you know, something that starts with the letter of the alphabet.
Okay.
So the title of this Abecedarian essay is Apothecarium. And so here's W. Wishful. Take quicksilver 1 part, nitrous acid 2 parts, hog's lard 12 parts. Stir them together in a marble mortar. After just one gemcitabine Tarceva chemotherapy session, my mother waved off bags and needles in favor of hospice. My father pushed the hospice brochures to the far corner of the coffee table and spent days at the computer and on the phone searching for clinical trials. And then this is why, yearning. Dr. Hank's rheumatism physic. Take butternut bark and white ash, put in 2 quarts of water, boil it down to 1 pint. Add brandy and loaf sugar. Let it stand. One day, deep into Mom's illness, I came home from some errand. I stepped to the front door and heard my mother playing her dulcimer. It stopped me, 1 foot on the top step, 1 hand on the screen door handle. It was the sound of home. Mom had always worried that her rheumatism would eventually make it impossible for her to play her flute and her dulcimer. Cancer and cortisone injections cured that worry. Still, she rarely played after her diagnosis. Perhaps it was more difficult to imagine the loss of music than the loss of life. How could her tone-deaf husband and her tone-deaf children possibly understand? And then the last section of this essay is called Zenith. For a cancer, take the juice of kokum leaves, sweet Sicily roots, and ginseng roots, and put it on a plate and set it in the sun till it evaporates to the consistency of a plaster. Then put on the plaster just big enough to cover the cancer and keep it on, and in a few days, the cancer will come out by the roots. I once saw this epitaph on a 19th century North Carolina headstone. How little we appreciate a mother's love while living. The stone was so weather-worn that the word mother had become moth.
Beautiful, thank you. Yeah, it's so beautiful and also difficult to hear, even as a listener, as a reader. It's tough to hear about that, you know, especially the beautiful you know, comment about music and its role is lovely and very, very sad. So so how many essays are in this? That's a complete project already, is that correct?
Well, the one that I just read the last 3 bits of, you know, one essay, and so I imagine the full collection being 12 essays, and I just finished number 7, I think it was, last night, or no, today's Wednesday. On Monday, I finished it and sent it out, submitted it for possible publication. And so I have another 5 essays that are in various stages in the process, and I'm hoping to finish the whole collection. Well, my goal is to finish it by my 50th birthday, which is the end of October of this year.
And those will be published perhaps in magazines or publications or online as they're being done? Is that how they get out?
Yeah, so the one that I just read from was published in Story Quarterly, which is a literary magazine, the literary magazine of Rutgers University. And then there's another that was actually on Lit Hub. I guess that was last June 2017. It was published online on Lit Hub. It had earlier been published in the Literary Journal, and then it was also published in an anthology called Beautiful Flesh, A Body of Essays, that was edited and published last year from the Colorado Center for Literary Publishing. And so it's a collection of essays that are all about different parts of the body. And my mother had cancer of the pancreas, so I wrote an essay about the pancreas, and it ended up in that anthology.
So let's read a little bit about, or let's talk a little bit about some poems that you've translated. Can you tell me a little bit about that, how that project began? And I know you were going to read one or two from there. So tell me a little bit about that project, which is also in progress, or is that finished?
It's not finished in the sense that it's published. It's finished in the sense that the collection is finished. So I have been working for a number of years, I think since 2010, with a poet in southern Mexico. I wrote a book that was published in 2011 called No Word for Welcome, which is about community activism in indigenous communities in southern Mexico and how they are dealing with globalization, all kinds of globalization, economic globalization, cultural globalization, et cetera. And so one big part of that struggle on the part of those communities is keeping their languages alive. There are languages that are in danger of extinction. Half of the languages in the world right now, more than half probably at this point, are in danger of extinction, which means that they have less than 250,000 speakers, which is actually the threshold that linguists often use to determine whether a language is endangered. And so as part of working on this book, I got very interested in local literatures in southern Mexico and how people who are writing poetry and other forms of literature in indigenous languages, in their home languages, are working to, one, to get their literature out into the world and also to protect their languages, many of which have, many, many fewer than 250,000 speakers. So one of those languages, which is called Zapotec, there are several kinds of Zapotec. This is Isthmus Zapotec is what it's called, which has probably something a little less than 100,000 speakers. There are many poets working in this language. One of them is Irma Pineda, and she and I have become good friends. And so I have completed one collection in English of her work. She works in both Isthmus Zapotec and in Spanish, so all of her poetry, or nearly all of her poetry, is bilingual. And then I create an English version, working from mostly from her Spanish versions, but I also work with her, and she tells me kind of what's going on in the Zapotec version of the poem. Interestingly, Irma Pineda is a person who also writes a lot about death, and she is quite well known in the part of Mexico that she's from because her parents were really important political activists, and her father disappeared. He was probably killed by people working on behalf of the Mexican government when Irma was a small child. That happened in the late 70s. And so a lot of her early poems and even some of her continuing poems are about that loss of her father and sort of imagining the relationship that she never got to have with him because he disappeared from her life when she was so young. So I'll read one poem that's from that first collection, which I've finished the translation of, but is not published yet. And this is one that is available online. It was published in the Kenyon Review. And so this poem is called Death Surprised You. And here is the English version of it. Death surprised you in a place far from home, from your people. You were thrown nameless in a hole, without belongings, without prayers, without flowers, without songs to brighten the way for your feet. And you stand at the beginning of a path while your mother seeks someone newly dead to entrust with your favorite clothes, the flowers that never scented your body, the cries that never filled your ears. She knows you await her. And so that poem is from one of Irma Pineda's first collections of poetry, which was originally published in 2005, and the title of the collection in English would be In the Belly of the Night.
Wow, yeah, that's beautiful. And it's kind of fascinating, too, as a translator, that you're also having access. I mean, it's kind of a wonderful process because you're keeping a language alive, and since you're talking with a poet, the chances that you're getting it right are really good, right? Because you're also being told the kind of essence behind the poem, which is
right.
Really what you'd have to guess at otherwise.
Right, exactly. And Irma Pineda's poems, a lot of them are very deeply rooted in Zapotec history, and she's very conscious about wanting to keep the knowledge of lost traditions alive, you know, for young Zapotecs. And so there's a way in which, you know, when after I sit down and talk with her about one of her poems, I have notes all over the page. And if I were a scholar, I would probably publish a translation that almost every single line had a footnote with a long explanation of this is a literary reference to X. This is a reference to this aspect of, you know, Zapotec funerary culture. Or, you know, there's a way in which every line of the poem is a reference to some practice that is either been lost or she fears will be lost. But, you know, I'm not a scholar, and so I don't do that. I just try to sort of do the best I can with what I have access to in English, you know, to bring that poem into a different language and a different culture.
Right. Well, that makes sense. And you're going to read us one more from the poet, from a translation?
Yes. Let me see what other ones I have here. Yes, so this is a poem that's from about the same era in her work, and it doesn't have a title, but it has sort of a dedication. It's a poem dedicated to someone, and so the dedication is to Gerardo Garcia for not embracing forgetting. Dawn's loneliness weighs on me like my eyelids when half asleep. I want to find your body among the hammock threads, your absence a river filling my throat. I want a cloud-reaching cry to burst from me, begging my ancestors to watch over your footsteps. I repeat my grandmother's words in front of the memory stone, so you will remember the way back to me. I will wait for you reclining in my afternoon easy chair, counting the spots painted on the jaguar, that ancestor in my family tree. I will scrape scales from the alligator sorcerer so your skin will sting when you try to forget us.
Wow, very powerful work. Thank you for reading those to us. Very, very strong poems. So I guess to look at that whole series, you know, it's such powerful material, right? And I'm about to ask you the last question, but just to go back on this material a little bit, your essay, these poems, so much about death. As you process all of this, it sounds like it's obviously not, or maybe it is, correct me if I'm wrong, weighing on you and making this process so difficult. Is there, because you're confronting and talking and writing and translating about death, how does that feel? Does that feel like not the burden that many of us would associate with that kind of immersion in a subject that so many are trying to avoid?
I don't know if I would call it a burden. I would definitely say that I find that I will avoid working on this project with all my might. And so part of the reason that I've, you know, only finished 7 essays, even though it's been 11 years since my mother died, was that I only work on the essay project when I am not having to go to work. I'm away from home. You know, if I have a couple of weeks at an artist residency, I will pull out this project and work on it. And so the progress has been very slow for that reason. So I guess I would say it's not a burden because I mostly don't have it in my day-to-day life. And partly that's because I find that when I immerse myself in the subjects of grief and death and loss, it is very sad, and it makes me, you know, it's very hard for me to then shift gears and go teach my classes or just be in the world as a, you know, understanding human being. I find I just want to squirrel away and only be in that sad space of thinking about grief, if that makes sense. In the case of translating Irma Pineda's work, she does write about grief and death a lot. The collection of her works that I'm working on right now translating is actually about a rape and murder case of a woman in Mexico that was an event that received a lot of media coverage in Mexico, very little in the U.S. And translating those poems is quite is agonizing is the word that comes to mind, although that seems far too melodramatic. But I'm really happy that Irma Pineda's most recent book, which is coming out next month, and I will eventually translate, it's called Rojo Deseo, or Red Desire, and it is a collection of love poems. So it will be, you know, a little bit easier to sort of get into that space and then go on with my life.
Of course. Well, Wendy, thanks so much. Before we go, I wanted to ask you what you're reading at the moment, a question I ask everyone at the end. Could be off topic or not.
I am one of those folks that reads a bunch of different things at once. So one of the things I'm reading is that new collection of Irma Pineda's Rojo Deseo, which is coming out in March, and as sort of preparation for thinking about beginning to translate it. I'm also reading a collection of poetry by another Mexican poet. Her name is Miquea Sanchez. And the collection I'm reading is not available in English, but she is included in an anthology that was published last year that I highly recommend, that is called Like a New Sun. It's an anthology with 6 different Mexican poets translated into English, and that was published by Phoneme Media.
Wendy, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to have the opportunity to talk about this work.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.